Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, episode 329. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by the fine, fine people at Hack Labs, an Australian penetration testing and security consulting firm. Do check them out at hacklabs.com. There's no feature interview in this week's show. If you tuned in last week, you would have heard HD Moore and I talking about a project called Invisible.im, which is basically my baby, although not so much anymore. We launched the FAQ last week, and it turns out the internet likes the idea. It really likes the idea. So I've spent much of the last week working on Invisible.im stuff. And yeah, there's some really cool stuff happening there that I can't really talk about yet, but I can say the project has picked up a lot of interest. And there have been some major developments that have basically put it about a year ahead of where we thought we were going to be after a week. Sorry to be so cryptic, but yeah, there is some very cool stuff happening, and I'll be able to talk about it more soon. But in this week's show, we're going to have a chat about the week's InfoSec news with Adam Boileau, and then we'll have a really interesting talk with Chris Gatford, head honcho with Hack Labs, all about the case of the Public Transport Victoria website receiving what I like to call a free pen test from a 16-year-old kid. He reported a bug, didn't hear anything back after a couple of days, then went to the press. The whole thing blew up, and he wound up having all of his computers basically taken away by the police, and it looked for a time like he would be facing charges. The whole episode came to a conclusion. About a week ago, the kid had to sign a statement acknowledging that he'd committed a crime, but beyond that, there was no other sanction. Unsolicited pen tests are a murky, murky area, and Chris joins us to chat about this case, and also more generally about how we might move towards some sort of consensus on how things should actually happen in these situations. That is coming up a bit later, but let's kick off the show now properly with a check of the week's InfoSec news with Adam Boileau. And Adam, we've got a few really interesting stories in this week's news, and a couple that are more or less follow-ups on things that we've been saying will be interesting to keep an eye on. You know, we've been waiting for these follow-ups. One of them is Ross Ulbricht, of course, the alleged founder of the Silk Road website. There was a really interesting idea floated some time ago which said he couldn't have been laundering bitcoins because bitcoins are a thing and not money, and you can't launder things. And he's also been saying his defense team has argued, well, it's just like eBay, really. You know, he's just hosting a platform for commerce, so charging him with drug trafficking is a bit rich. Judgment has come back on those two arguments saying nope and nope.
Yeah, which is, to be fair, probably what we expected, but kind of goes to show, you know, this, you know, whenever you give a hacker a copy of the law, you end up with some rules weaseling going on. It turns out that actually judges not so fond of rules weaseling. And this was a pretty good example of that. I mean, they tried to argue that, the Silk Road was in fact a crack house. So it was a law in the US, which basically said that, landlords were responsible for, letting people, sell crack out of their houses, but it wasn't the same as being actually selling the crack. And so they were, attempting to say, well, even if it isn't eBay, then actually it's just a crack house.
And the judge said, if this is a crack house, it's an amazing crack house. It basically had signs out the front saying, crackheads, come on in, and specially designed traps and concealed entrances. And, they really tore the defense team a new one. But this was just a motion to dismiss the charges. He's actually pled not guilty to all counts. So I think this is like, regardless of whether or not the charges are proven, they shouldn't be brought in the first place. So here's a motion to dismiss. But it looks like the charges won't be dismissed and it's going to go to trial.
Yeah, it sounds that way. I mean, I guess if I was running the Silk Road, which I wasn't, then I wouldn't make any bitcoins because they're not real money and therefore I can't launder them. Yeah, no, we're going to end up following, I guess, the story once again as it goes to trial.
Yeah, he's going to have to find a different way out of these ones, guy. So Edward Snowden, moving to some other news. And Edward Snowden, and, we've definitely been predicting this one for some time. A year ago, he got himself temporary asylum in Russia. That time is coming to an end. He is now applying for some more time in Russia because he doesn't want to wind up in Gitmo, I'm guessing.
It seems pretty reasonable, really, doesn't it? There's some discussion that he's been also applying elsewhere, but of course he doesn't have a valid passport at the moment, so he can't exactly travel to, Cuba or Ecuador or go hang out with Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy. So yes, he's going to apply for, I guess, at least another year in Russia, and there's no discussion yet as to whether or not he's actually applying for, residence or any longer-term citizenship in Russia or just extending it.
Yeah, I don't know that anyone would really want to be stuck with Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy. To be honest, it sounds like a pretty confined space. So.
Yeah, not really a party.
Yeah, Now, staying with all things Russia and the United States, you know, things between the US and Russia haven't been amazing lately, you know, and the US has actually recently arrested a Russian politician's son over some computer crime related charges, and Russia not very happy, calling it kidnapping and all sorts of stuff. Much wailing and gnashing of teeth, as we like to say.
Yeah, this guy, Valery Selesnev, was arrested in the Maldives, apparently accused of attacking a number of computer systems in the US. I mean, it sounded like fairly common garden hacking, you know, broke into a branch of Shlotsky's deli, also the Phoenix Zoo. So, you know, really some fairly serious international crimes going on there.
Yes, Shlotsky's deli, I mean, that's big business. Talking about serious, yeah. Serious interfering serious, in commerce there.
Serious smoked meat.
And obviously worth going to the Maldives to pursue this charge, and has nothing to do with wanting to piss off Russia or anything like that.
Nothing at all, I'm sure.
Nothing at all. Now, the Washington Post is carrying a very interesting story with regard to some of the Snowden material, saying that, you know, of all of the NSA data that has been sort of intercepted and stored, the number of people not targeted outnumber the number of foreigners who were targeted. So, in other words, there's been a lot of collateral collection, shall we say. And no real surprise there.
No.
That's kind of why everyone's pissed off in the first place, I would have thought, you know.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, this is the core crux of the argument against the surveillance state, isn't it? That despite the fact that they assert that it's warranted and that it's all collected, you know, sort of with legitimate authorization, there is always going to be collateral collection, collateral damage there. And, I mean, it's difficult not to have some sympathy for the intelligence agencies, I guess, because, you know, I certainly know as a hacker, right, you often don't know you know, what something is until you bust into it, right? And it's the same way with surveillance. You don't really know whether you're looking at communications between, you know, a valid target or not, or what that's about, until you've actually intercepted it and looked at it. And, you know, doing so without, you know, actually hitting collateral, you know, people who aren't related as you know, collateral collection, you know, is impossible, and balancing the needs are there is you know, a challenge for everyone involved, I'm sure. But
it is a diabolical challenge. I mean, I'll give you that. But I mean, we've seen some unsavory stuff come out over the last week. I think there was a, you know, there's like a Pfizer dummy warrant or an application sort of form where the placeholder for the name of the person targeted by the warrant is Muhammad Raghead.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you see stuff like that, and you just think, which bonehead, you know, I thought that was a good idea.
Well, exactly. I guess they weren't expecting that to be leaked. But yeah, no, that wasn't a particularly good look. dear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
a security researcher may or may not have been fired for disclosing some bugs in FireEye. This is a fascinating story, isn't it?
Yeah, so there's a story about this researcher, Jean-Marie Bourbon, Bourbon perhaps, I'm not sure, who was an employee, may still be an employee, it's a little unclear, of a security company called Sagetti. And he published some security research into FireEye, had some disclosed some bugs in FireEye's like, you know, security appliance thing. And those were published on ExploitDB. They got, he got asked to pull them from ExploitDB. And then there was some fallout that resulted in him either being fired or suspended, from the place where he worked. And it turned out that they had done some work with FireEye, and there may have been some non-disclosure agreements involved. And it's all got a little bit unclear and all very, very messy. And as the sort of, you know, drama between researchers and security companies and, contracting companies that, you know, it doesn't do anyone any good in the industry, I think, whether you're a vendor or a researcher.
Yeah, it's sort of reminiscent of the Carl Lynn, you know, ISS, IBM thing, you know. Oh, was it IBM? I can't even remember. Oh,
wow,
it was Cisco.
Cisco,
yeah.
Yeah.
So there was that, you know, there was Barnaby and his ATM research. You know, we see stories like this pop up every now and then, but I think the general understanding is that the company that this gentleman worked for actually had an NDA with FireEye, so that when he was actually, you know, publishing stuff, you know, bugs in their code, and presumably he had access to, you know, images to test because of that contract that they had, and, you know, FireEye did their block, and, you know, they're very publicity conscious when it comes to the security of their product. I know this because I sat through a presentation at Breakpoint last year, and, you know, it was Jonathan Brossard's talk on FireEye bugs, and I found that talk very interesting. And before I'd even planned on writing anything, I was getting calls from FireEye PR, because the FireEye guy in the room rang the PR team because I was there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So they're really, great talk, though.
It was a great talk, but they're very, very, very image conscious and aggressively try to maintain their image of their kit being absolutely wonderful. So it doesn't necessarily, you know, surprise me that a situation like this may have arisen with FireEye.
Yeah, and I've certainly heard similar sorts of stories. But it does serve to highlight, you know, really the, you know, quite difficult lines that our security researchers sometimes have to, you know, walk along, you know, balancing, you know, where reverse engineering is legal, where you have access to the kit, what the relationship between you and the customer and the vendor and all those kind of things. It can be a real quagmire. And I know there's certain times where I've looked at bugs we found or, you know, research, you know, lines where you can see there are going to be bugs and you choose not to go down them just because you know that, you know, there isn't a clear way that you can defend your research. And, you know, bugs go unfound and things go owned because of it.
Well, we'll just have to see what the fallout's like for this guy, Jean-Marie Bourbon. How do you pronounce that? You've got a French-sounding last name.
I'm dithering between just Bourbon, which would be a pretty awesome last name. Well, yeah, Bourbon, maybe.
Mr. Bourbon to you.
Dr. Bourbon.
Hey, there we go. Oh, now here's a story we haven't seen in a little while. Google has been dealing with some, you know, like a popped CA writing out some bad certs for its properties. Less of an issue than it was a couple of years ago because there's a great deal of cert pinning these days.
Yeah, so this is a story in which an intermediate cert in India, which is whose root cert's in the Microsoft's trusted cert store, was being used to sign certificates for, amongst other things, some Google properties, some Yahoo web properties. Google spotted this, and this is, I guess, a good win for, you know, both the cert pinning that Google does, but also the use of things like SSL Observatory and, you know, spotting the use of certificates that don't match the real things in the wild from the browser. Anyway, they've identified this. Google pushed out an update which blacklisted that particular cert authority from Chrome or Windows. So obviously, it was only in the Windows cert store at that point. Microsoft, I believe, has followed up doing a similar sort of thing. But yeah, it's a good, it's an example of the kind of problem we've become used to with the CA infrastructure, but also the fact that it was spotted and mitigated relatively quickly is, some slight indication that we're starting to get a handle on, on dealing with these problems.
Yeah. Look, and the fact of it is, you know, if you're using good quality software, if you're using good quality browsers and, you know, mail software these days, they should throw up a few warnings, even when the cert has been signed by a valid CA, you know?
Well, we are seeing more and more cert pinning, but I mean, you know, you do have to trust the operating system cert store. I mean, this is Microsoft's job to ensure that the certs that are in its root key, in root CA list are trustworthy. And
yeah, like the Shanghai Post Office and others.
well, exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did think it was interesting, though, there's a quote in this article that basically said that the real solution to this problem for Google is to just destroy the business model of the CA infrastructure and run their own, you know, essentially free, good quality CA and just take out VeriSign and everybody else's business models, which, you know, it's hard to argue with that being a bad idea.
Yeah, but you got to wonder if they want to take on the headache. Do you know what I mean? You got to wonder if the solution is just to detonate all of the CAs and have one organization like Google trying to step in. I don't know, man. It'd get messy real quick, you know? Or whether the solution is going to be more along the lines of some of the stuff Moxie Marlon Spike suggested.
Yeah, or maybe DNSSEC will actually, you know, get there. Yeah.
Yeah, good luck with that guy. Now, staying with Google, and last week or the week before, sorry, I'm still just getting over that one. Okay, staying with Google, and last week or the week before, we reported that Goldman Sachs had accidentally sent a whole bunch of sensitive data to a Gmail address, and they were trying to get an injunction to get Google to delete the email out of the person's inbox because it was never intended to be sent there, blah, 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 blah. Seemed like they were going the right way about it, involving the courts, involving Google early on. Google has agreed to block access to that email. They've deleted it, and they have said that no one has accessed it. So, you know, even though this is a good result for an awful company, you still got to think this is a good precedent, right?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, of course, I wanted there to be lots of, juicy Goldman Sachs internal evil corporate secrets leaked out into, Chris Sahoyan's Gmail or something. But, Sadly, it appears that's not what's happened, and Google says that, in fact, no one's logged into the account, despite me exhorting our listeners last week to check if they had received the secret Goldman Sachs documents. And yeah, they've blocked access to it. Very sad for those of us who hate evil corporations.
Yes, the vampire octopus, as it is known. Microsoft has settled with no IP over this malware takedown in which legitimate domains were brought down. I actually had a comment from a listener who said, gee, you guys were kind of soft on Microsoft over that. And I guess, you know, my answer to that was, you know, they made a legitimate mistake, but they owned it pretty quick and moved to restore service, and now they've settled it. So, you know, I mean, I'm guessing they're going to be more careful in future, but they seem to have handled it relatively well, considering they did make the mistake in the first place.
Yeah, they do. And they, as you said, they appeared to own it relatively quickly. And I guess, you know, someone from Redmond, you know, took the flight down to NoIP's office and, you know, brought out the checkbook and, you know, what does it take to make this just, you know, just go away? And clearly the number was agreeable, and they have made it all go away, and everybody's all happy ever after. But yes, I mean, given how many, you know, successful processes, or how many times Microsoft has been successful in this process, I guess it was inevitable that they would eventually screw something up, and, you know, presumably they learned their lessons. And yeah, it's difficult to be too harsh on Microsoft for this. I think, you know, they were always going to push this as far as they could and then have to dial it back a bit when it went bad for them. And now they know where that is.
Yeah, I guess they found the edge, right?
Yeah.
And luckily they've got deep pockets, because it's always handy in situations like that. Oh, now from the Department of the Bleeding Obvious, also known as the No Surprise News, Chinese hackers target U.S. government workers, says report. I mean, I just said, yeah, of course, yes, well, they do, according to the New York Times, yes.
What are they going to do, like go after Miley Cyrus? No. It looks like they compromised the Office of Personnel Management and gained access to some data about federal employees, clearances, that kind of thing, which you'd imagine would be very, very useful for understanding organizational structures and who to target for phishing, and, you know, to be able to, you know, better prosecute the kinds of attacks that we've seen them use against the US government. So, I mean, you know, it's exactly, as you say, it's exactly the sort of thing we would expect them to be doing.
Indeed. And, you know, screams the headline from the next piece, CNetNews.com, China cyber spies hit US national security think tanks. Again, no real surprise there.
Well, no, exactly. And what's funny is this is based on a report that's come out of CrowdStrike, where they're talking about the Deep Panda crew, who've been owning all sorts of things for all sorts of time. What's funny is that CrowdStrike apparently do like pro bono free work for US military industrial think tanks that don't have enough money to pay for security. Well, I guess it's one way to get free, free test data to build your ISEs from. But the idea of, you know, military industrial think tanks that are, you know, so starved for cash that they can't afford to, you know, update to the Windows 7 or something. I'm weeping. I'm crying.
Lots of weeping and crying and laughing.
I'm very emotional this week. Yeah,
it is a very emotional week in risky business. Now, I'm guessing there are a bunch of emotional people out there, because a group of guys did a study where they bought 20 pre-owned smartphones off eBay, Android phones, and the sheer volume of dick pics they managed to pull off these devices. I mean, I'm surprised. I'm more surprised by the dick pic density out there than I am by the fact that you can recover files off supposedly erased phones. It's staggering. Who likes dick pics? You know?
There's quite a lot of people who allegedly like dick pics. Well, what was that guy for that? Was a US politician, like Anthony Weiner or something?
Yeah,
awful
yeah,
name.
Yeah.
If you're going to send dick pics, sending dick pics to people on Twitter. Like, I can understand, like, you take a dick pic on your phone, you Snapchat it to your buddy, hi, Snare, and then, you know, that's all fine. But why would you send it to people on Twitter?
Yeah, well, he accidentally didn't direct message. He actually wound up just doing an at reply, which is how that all came up.
Oops. Oh, dear. But anyway, so the real meat, if you'll excuse me, of the story. The real meat of the story is, of course, that the factory wiping or factory resetting your phone doesn't actually delete the dick pics from your phone. And then if you put it on eBay, people buy them and recover your dick pics. And then presumably either laugh at your dick or enjoy it, depending on their perspective. Maybe both.
I find it all very strange. Briefly, I want to cover this, but people who are more interested in it can have a look at the Wired write-up. Kevin Poulsen's got a great story there about how people can basically just hijack your Google Maps entry, you know, your Google Places entry, and just destroy your business by saying stuff like, you know, these guys are only open from 2 to 3 p.m., you know, every second Tuesday of the month, you know, and it's actually caused some serious damage out there to a bunch of businesses.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen this happen. It was, I suppose, more prevalent a couple of years back, where people were, you know, hijacking Google's business listings or hijacking the maps, you know, posting fake reviews to, you know, infect their competitors' businesses. But Kevin Poulsen's write-up's quite funny, because it covers a restaurant in the US that, amongst other things, sold lion meat.
Yeah, and anyway, it used to sell bear meat, but they're not allowed to import it anymore.
I don't know where they get their lions from. Either way, he's not getting any lions anymore because somebody changed his Google Maps thing to say that he was only open not on Saturday and Sunday. And anyways, attempted to sue Google for this, despite never having used Google before because he was too busy killing and eating lions. but yes, I guess no surprise to us in the InfoSec industry, but it's probably worth, you know, if you've got friends or relatives that operate small businesses, to make sure they do actually go through the process of registering their business with Google. And there's a Google mails you out a thing that you use to, you know, kind of authenticate your physical location, and then, you know, actually actively curate your presence there rather than letting somebody else do it for you.
Well, I mean, this is something Rule of Temming of Multigo fame has been on about for years, which is, you know, even if you don't like Facebook, even if you don't like Twitter, even if you don't like LinkedIn, just set one up. Don't add anything to it, but just leave it there so that you can actually control your identity, because that's, you know, that's a pretty positive thing.
Yeah, and
letting someone else control it.
Certainly when you work with jerks like I do, then, making sure that making sure that they, you don't get, like, metal storm at Snapchat taken away from you by somebody else registering it first. High snare. yeah, exactly.
I'm cottoning on to what's going on here.
I know,
that's,
right?
That's quite cool. Now, switching over to some news from your home country, Adam, and your Minister for Internal Affairs, Peter Dunn, has defended the New Zealand government's, 40,000 government computers still running XP, saying, hey, give us a break. You know, it's all good. We'll get there. I mean, yeesh.
Yeah, it is rather embarrassing, isn't it? But no, our minister is suggesting that it was unreasonable of us to expect the government to have some kind of central plan for requiring government agencies to go and do this, actually give them any reasonable advice. The idea was that they should just be left for themselves and they'll figure it out, you know, it'll be fine. And of course, now we are at XP cutoff date, and like our national police and a bunch of other stuff all runs on XP, and
like 40,000 computers too. That's most of the computers in New Zealand, I would have thought.
That is, in fact, most of the computers in New Zealand, yes. I mean, the police only have one, but other than that, the other 39,999 distributed amongst the other government departments are all doing very serious business. So on the plus side, right, the Chinese broke into our weather prediction supercomputer and presumably patched Java for us. So thanks, guys.
Well, speaking of Java, Oracle has finally ditched Java support for Windows XP. And it's just like, I mean, the imagery that this conjures up of Java on XP, you know, and the idea that they were still supporting it even now, considering support has actually ended for a while now. Why would you keep support? This is just nuts.
It is. It's very funny. Of course, there's just so many things wrong with this. Like the idea that anyone who runs XP would actually care about patching their Java at all and like give a shit in the first place. I mean, every XP box that I've seen in prod in the last couple of weeks runs Java 1.4, right? I mean, you know, there's no one who has XP patches their Java, right? It doesn't matter, Oracle.
Well,
you could have just given
people
up
who have their
ago.
XP don't patch their XP anymore either. So.
Well, exactly. They don't patch anything. But anyway, they got one less thing to worry about patching now because they can't patch their Java either.
Oh, there's going to be a lot of own boxes in China.
Let me rephrase.
There's going to be a lot more owned boxes in China.
Does it count if the box is already owned and you own it again? Like, is that two owned boxes? Or that's just one owned box that's owned twice. So I think we all see a lot of owned boxes own some more.
A lot of competing botnets. FireEye have an interesting write-up on a point-of-sale campaign. You know, a bunch of people going around and, like, brute-forcing common cred pairs, I think, for some standard off-the-shelf POS systems, but they're going in through like remote desktop, you know, and just trying a whole bunch of default creds.
Yeah, you can make some real money out of that, but, just scanning the internet for IDP and trying, you know, admin POS, admin password, which is what this particular botnet was doing, you know, clearly is a thing that still makes you rich somehow.
Yeah, I mean, they said that they had 5,000 machines, you know, they were using 5,000 machines to brute their way into about 60 systems. So I should say there were 60 POS systems owned at that point that they know of. But yeah, an interesting write-up.
Yeah, it is. It is interesting. And yeah, obviously, you know, you'd hope the POS systems, I guess any POS systems that are left on the internet, hopefully by now are all honeypots, but.
Oh, now this story is absolutely frickin' hilarious. Yeah, I know. You nearly died. You nearly died just thinking about this. Someone lodged a Freedom of Information request about Operation Aurora, about the Operation Aurora attack on Google. So they applied to the Department of Homeland Security and said, we want information on Operation Aurora. And what came out instead was information about a different Operation Aurora, which was a SCADA war game run by DHS like a million years ago. But funnily enough, the Idaho National Lab documents, you know, they were the guys who ran the actual exercise. Those documents themselves have proved to be quite interesting. So although DHS have coughed up the wrong docs, still pretty interesting.
Yeah, no, so you may have listeners may remember the video that was floating around the internet a couple of years back, which was Department of Homeland Security people blowing up a generator.
Yeah, it was in 2007. It was like sitting there wobbling and smoking and stuff. It was the end of their sort of war game was to get this thing to physically screw up.
Yeah, so apparently that was the other Project Aurora that all of this documentation is about. I mean, as you said, it is quite interesting stuff. And I guess this demonstrates quite a good methodology, which is to, go through all of these, codename generators and start filing FOIA requests for, Project Screaming Weasel and see what you get.
Yeah, I guess we'll just have to wait and see if they cough up anything. You know, I just wouldn't know how much DHS itself would have on Project Aurora against Google. You'd think NSA would have more than that than DHS, wouldn't you?
You would think, but I guess, maybe they... I guess they wouldn't have filed the request if they didn't think there was something there to find. But, it's...
And people think governments are that organized in persecuting us. We're going to move into a bug roundup now, and there's a pretty nasty one. It's a local in Android, which is like a permissions bypass, so you can write a malicious app that can make phone calls. This is really bad for things like toll fraud.
Yeah, so this is basically a thing where you can send like a message onto the message bus on the Android in a way that bypasses the permission controls and allows you to, for example, make phone calls, send text messages, that kind of thing, without the necessary permission to do so. And of course, yes, if someone has got a malicious app on their phone that wants to do toll fraud or wants to send premium SMS or spam or whatever else, then it can do so despite not having that permission. And that's obviously something that is, people are going to use and monetize. It's a pretty, it's a vector we've certainly seen used in the past.
Yeah.
So yes, you're going to have to get that one patched. Apparently all but the newest versions of Android KitKat are vulnerable to this particular bug.
Oh, Yahoo, meanwhile, has patched a whole bunch of bugs in Mail, Messenger, and Flickr, which you'd imagine, Alex Stamos is over there now getting pretty busy. So I'd imagine we're going to be seeing a lot more announcements along these lines now that they have a CISO.
Yes, and a bug bounty program that pays off more than just T-shirts. I gather at least one of these bugs was worth something like $1,000 to the guy who reported it.
He can go buy his own T-shirts.
He can. He can buy several T-shirts, unless they're designer ones.
Oh, and Adobe, meanwhile, has patched a Flash bug that I've seen a little bit of buzz about. I mean, it seemed like it was a pretty interesting one, this one.
Yeah, it is an interesting bug. It's a you may have seen it talked about as relating to the JSONP cross-site request forgery, and I had to reread the description of this bug 3 or 4 times before I actually understood what was going on. Because it's one of these like weird web 2.0 like interaction between 4 or 5 different legitimate behaviors of the browser ecosystem that results in actually quite bad things.
So it's sort newfangled stuff. Beardy guy does not approve.
Exactly. Yeah. No, like the inner curmudgeon of me wrote it off very, very quickly. But I reread it a couple of times and got Pipes to explain it to me again a couple of times. But yeah, it's basically universal cross-site request forgery where the target has a JSONP endpoint, which is a particular type of kind of Ajaxy, newfangled, JavaScript web thing that I don't approve of. But anyway, universal cross-site request forgery using Flash and some very clever clever tricks with making Flash applets that are actually also printable ASCII. Anyway, the actual process that's been went through to do this is very, very interesting, worth reading. But if you're doing web testing, I would absolutely go and read this bug because it's one of the more interesting ones that we've seen of this type. Universal cross-site request forgery is a thing that's relevant to all of our interests, but in particular, if you're testing web stuff, this is worth reading about.
Yep, indeed. Microsoft's July patch Tuesday is a doozy. We've got 29 IE vulnerabilities. Are many of them critical?
There's a couple that are certainly pretty critical. There's also some bugs in Microsoft Windows Journal, a note-taking application. I don't know how the hell you managed to screw that up. But yes, there's the full set of Microsoft things to go patch, but you're used to that process, I'm sure.
Didn't we see something in Notepad years ago?
I wouldn't be surprised. That or Paintbrush, anyway. Yeah, maybe Minesweeper. That had some pretty sweet bugs.
There was it? There was something in one of those basic Windows apps that was very, very funny. But and Adam, before we go, one of your former colleagues is picking up all sorts of very friendly press from Wired. Our buddy Morgan Marquis-Bois is all over Wired for being the ex-Google hacker taking on the world's spy agencies. Very puffy piece, this one.
Yeah, no, it's a real funny piece. And, of course, you know, Morgan's there looking the part very much so with his, you know, dreadlocks and his bandana and things. And those of us, I suppose, from the Kiwi scene who grew up with Morgan, you know, may not buy into all of the puff, but you know, Morgan has been doing good work at Google over the years, and of course is off to go work on OPSEC for Kim Greenwald. And you know, if there's a thankless job in the world, I don't know, that's probably it, I think. So you know, he may need all the puff he's going to get with the NSA now trying to hack his employer. But
well, do you think you know, do you think this might actually shake him out of his innate humility?
do I have to answer that question?
But it's nice. Look, it's nice to see Morgan getting a write-up. Mate, that is actually it. That is it for the week's news. It's been a silly
probably
one this week.
Probably for the best, yes.
Probably for the best.
Mate, it's been spent teenage years with Morgan in a bar. Probably best I should say no. I should say nothing. Nothing at all.
Nothing. I say nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing. Okay, buddy. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat to you this week, as always. And we'll catch you again next week.
I look forward to it, Pat.
Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's news headlines. This week's show is sponsored by Hack Labs. If you want a professional pen test, do check them out at hacklabs.com. But yeah, around Christmas time last year, Public Transport Victoria, PTV, they received a free pen test from a 16-year-old kid named Joshua Rogers. Rogers reported an SQL injection bug to them that coughed up something like 600,000 database records. He reported that to them on December 26. And I should explain that here in Australia, basically nothing happens anywhere between Christmas Day and like the second Monday in January. Nothing happens at all. Everyone's just having time off. Well, when Josh didn't hear back, after a few days, he contacted a newspaper. There was a story and PTV put the police onto him. Now, some of you will remember that this, you know, it kind of sounds a bit similar to the case of Pat Webster, a professional pen tester who discovered a direct object reference bug in his pension funds website, or what we'd say here is his superannuation funds website. And he had the police set on him also. Now, some people say this case is similar. But then again, a direct object reference bug is a bit different to an SQL injection attack. In the former, the data is inadvertently published, in essence. In the latter, not so much. So this case is a pretty complicated one. Late last week, it was revealed that Rogers has escaped prosecution. He was made to sign a piece of paper acknowledging that he had committed a crime, but he's more or less off the hook. So what does this whole thing teach us about disclosure? When to involve the police, and just how far members of the public should go when finding and disclosing bugs like these? After all, the injection bug that he found did expose a lot of private information on Victorians. Chris Gatford of Hack Labs, join me by phone to chat about it. Here's what he had to say.
Look, I certainly think there's some lessons can be learned from this exercise. You know, the researcher was obviously enthusiastic, and I think he probably overstepped the mark just to a little bit of a degree here by pulling actually down a lot of the data. In fact, I believe it's hard to confirm from the stories, but it was talked about he's pulled down 600,000 records.
Yeah, but it's also that he was actually using SQL injection to do this. I mean, people were trying to compare it to Pat Webster's first state superannuation fiasco when he noticed a direct object reference vulnerability. And exploiting that isn't really hacking, you know, whereas using SQL injection, and once you start actually interacting with the database, you've kind of crossed a line, haven't you?
You have, although I would point out Patrick did create a script to pull down some of the data as well. So, you know, and if you look at both these researchers, their motivations are sound, and they did the right thing in reporting. Now, I think in Joshua's case, as opposed to Patrick's, he only waited a few days for a response back on the vulnerability that he disclosed to them. And it was over, obviously, our holiday period, Christmas. So, you know, I think it was probably a little bit unrealistic to expect a response back from them quite so quickly. And he then forwarded it on straight on to a journalist who was obviously going to run with it and create a story.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think this kid did a lot of things that were wrong. But at the same time, look, I think...
I don't necessarily think... I mean... Wrong's a strong word. I think you know, he found a vulnerability. He wanted to show it was a problem, and he communicated it, and he was surprised when people didn't respond back quite fast enough, and he escalated it.
Yeah. And he's also 16, right? So
yeah, and so I think we have to take that into consideration. And so, yes, he did do a few things wrong. Not massive, grievous wrong, but he did do a few things, probably incorrectly, that ended up where he is now.
Now, what do you think of the decision of PTV to actually ring the police? Because this is one where I'm like, I'm in two minds about it. I really am not sure whether or not that was the appropriate course of action.
I think they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't, right? I think it depends. This is, you're talking about a state government. And you know, if you imagine you're receiving that email and the guys presumably said, hey, look, you know, you've got an SQL injection vulnerability. I've exploited it. I've been able to pull down some records. You know, it's a lot of alarm bells for your average government worker to comprehend. I mean, let's face it, most government departments certainly don't have a response process. They don't have a detailed procedure to understand how to manage this type of incident.
Mm. Yeah, it's, as I say, I'm in two minds about it, because in one regard, the practical way to deal with this would have been to go, okay, well, look, you know, can we scrub any data that you've downloaded from there? You know, come in, we'll buy you a can of Coke and we'll look at fixing it. You know, I mean, that's probably one way to handle it. On the other hand, I mean, this is what First State Superannuation said. They said it's a compliance issue. You know, there is our corporate data, or in this case, government data that is now on your machine, and we need to go through proper channels, yada, yada, yada. But either way, I think everyone can agree. Well, I'm not sure. Maybe everyone doesn't. The way things have played out seems to me to be about right. I think a police caution, which for those out there who don't really know the way police cautions work in Australia, they basically don't mean anything. It's like if you're caught, you know, smoking a joint in a pub car park, they'll give you a police caution, which basically goes in the shredder as soon as the guys get back to the station.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a reference that was going to sit on his record for 5 years unless he did another offence.
So. Police record, not court records. It's meaningless, man. It's like it's like a you've been naughty note from the cops, yeah. You know?
Well, you know, the thing is, though, I'm hoping, you know, when Joshua gets out into the workforce, you know, this doesn't come back on him. But, you know, things on the internet live forever, right? So if you are a potential employer in the future and you're searching on Joshua, as you would be doing if you're doing good due diligence when hiring somebody, you know, this is going to come up.
But if this guy comes to you in, say, 8 years from now, he's got his CS degree, you know, and has been contributing to a whole bunch of security-themed projects, you run a shop that hires pen testers, would you hold it against him?
No, I wouldn't, but I'm in the industry. But if you think of your average corporate drone in HR going looking at his application, that scenario is going to be completely different to someone like me hiring him.
Now, I think this whole experience definitely makes the case. Well, first of all, I mean, you would think that a competent audit would have showed up these bugs in the first place. So there has been a failing there somewhere. You know, a 16-year-old kid with very little training shouldn't really be able to dump your database. I think we can agree on that. But also, I think it really does make the case that people need to have guidelines, don't they? To just say, here's what you can do, here's what you can't do. And if you do something, these are the limits, and here's how you should report it. Do you think that would have perhaps, you know, made this situation avoidable?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, we're often in the position of being provided either incidents.
Free pen tests, we call them.
incidents or tapping people on the shoulder and letting them know about problems that have been brought to our attention. And it is a hard road to run, and you know, there isn't a week that goes by that, you know, that we've put the phone down and just shaking our heads after the interaction that we've had with that potential contact. So, would it help? Yes. I think as an industry or as a culture, we probably need to have a guideline on what's too much, what's too little. Previous examples, you know, and obviously here in Australia now we've got two good ones here in Patrick and now Joshua, and setting out sort of a disclosures manifesto and setting out some of these rules. And then we probably need it to be approved by, you know, the powers that be to say, hey, this is a good approach.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder about that because I think any attempt to actually codify that into some sort of legislation is going to fail. You know what I mean? And that's why I'm kind of happy about what's happened in this situation, because the police have got involved. You know, they went and they seized all of his stuff. Then they really looked at it and said, are we really going to charge this guy? No, let's make him sign a statement saying he's acknowledging he's been naughty and then drop it, which is, you know, as I say, it just feels about right.
Yeah, in this case it does. But like, how do we stop this from occurring in the future? How do we stop organizations from overreacting? And how do we stop researchers from maybe just pushing it just a little bit too far? And I think laying out some rules might assist. Now, I agree, it won't go into legislation, but having some guidelines and those guidelines being approved by, say, the privacy commissioner and,
yeah,
you know, that would certainly assist, I think.
Now, that said, because of this kid's actions, and this is where it gets into really murky territory, because of this kid's actions, the privacy of the average Victorian has actually been enhanced. So the outcome for the average person in Victoria has actually been a pretty good one. So here we are saying, okay, well, we can see why they called the police and see how he did it was, you know, what he did was naughty. But at the end of the day, there has been a public benefit, hasn't there?
Yeah, no, I think it'd be hard not to argue that. Certainly any time vulnerabilities are closed down and those consumers...
Especially boneheaded, you know, SQL injection bugs that expose an awful lot of private data.
Yeah, well, you know, once again, it's never ceases to amaze us, you know, how frequently you still see SQL injection, which is now a 14-year-old vulnerability.
Mm. But you see why this is a conundrum, right? Because we can actually see how it's unfolded. We can see that he's actually done the wrong thing. And yet there's still a public interest outcome. So it just, you know, it sort of seems like it's always going to be something that's treated by a case by on a case-by-case basis. It's funny, though, because I know one person, you know, you were just saying that you were asked often to report issues to organisations. This is something that I'm asked to do every now and then. I might have a listener who's found some horrible, horrible bug, you know, whether that's usually like a direct object ref or data leakage or someone's database popping up in a Google search, you know, things like that. And you do get some reactions, which is like, no, we're okay. We're very secure. Thanks anyway. You know, and you're like, well, I'm looking at your entire database right now, man. You've published it into a web accessible directory and they don't even listen. So there's one guy who has an amazing track record of actually reporting stuff. Is quite often, if I have the feeling that there might be an adverse reaction, I ring a friend of yours and mine at the Australian Federal Police, and he makes the call. And what's really funny is when it's someone from the Australian Federal Police on the line, they listen and they don't call the police. Isn't that weird?
Yes, it is. And you know, over the years, I've developed a couple of strategies for trying to disclose stuff. And you know, I had a classic about a year ago, where I described the problem, the vulnerability, and asked to speak to somebody in IT. They put me through to the actual developer responsible for this quite well known large retail organization, and I explained the problem to him, and he turned around and said, "Actually, I don't want to know about that vulnerability," and put the phone down.
Oh my God, that's beautiful.
And I'm sitting there knowing I'm not the only one who knows about this vulnerability, and it would be a significant impact to a lot of consumers if it was exploited and the data populated out. So I thought about this, and so I rang back and I asked for internal audit.
Hello.
And they were very interested to receive that information and very interested to hear that it had been dismissed so carelessly.
Yeah, look, I'm dealing with I'm trying to give advice to a guy who's dealing with a pretty awful situation in the organization he works in, where he's found that an internal resource, which does have some external exposure, is storing plain text passwords, you know, and it's kind of a problem. It's, you know, completely less than ideal. But when he reaches out to the IT team, they're just like, "We are very secure and we take the security of our information very seriously," and he just can't get through. So maybe that's it. Maybe if you go around to the audit teams instead of the IT teams, you get a much better response.
You do. Yeah, they do assist. But then again, the organization has to be large enough to have an internal audit group, which is certainly not always the case.
Mm. So have you come up with any other strategies for actually making people listen? Because this is interesting.
Well, you know, I had a really interesting conversation with CEO the other day. And, you know, he said 5 years ago, I didn't even know this service existed. And, you know, I explained to him one of the problems I was having at the moment. And he's like, you know, as a CEO, if someone comes to me and that was disclosed to me, I'd drag the IT guy in and say, "Please explain." And I can guarantee as soon as I say, please explain, they'll say, well, we should be doing pen testing, but we're not. And he said, you know, there is no CEOs would take that so seriously. So unfortunately, the answer is, and in a lot of these cases, is escalate it as high as you can, get as much coverage, and make sure very senior management know about a vulnerability when you're trying to disclose it, in my opinion.
And I guess we haven't, you and I have been unable to reach a sort of moral consensus on this this kid's activities down in Victoria, hey?
Oh, look, you know, there's two things here, right? One, I hope someone is taking him under his wing and counselling him a little bit. And, you know, he's 16, for Christ's sake. Let's give the kid a little bit of a break. But at the same time, we keep getting a few of these lessons, and I think we'll have a consensus as a group, as an industry, hopefully, where we can sort of decide right from wrong. This is a bit blurry. I'm gonna err on the side of Joshua for this one, and hope that he understands perhaps the mistakes he made there.
Yeah, well, I'm actually quite glad that he hasn't received a criminal conviction or any sort of stain on his record. That is quite fortunate, but and I'm glad that we've seen a public benefit out of that. But I'm also thinking, naughty young man, don't be using SQL injection on people.
I'm sure he's learned his lesson. Let's hope the others out there they are thinking of similar activity also learn from that.
Let that be a lesson to you, young hacklings. All right, Chris Gatford, thank you very much for joining us to have a bit of a chat about that, about the PTV case. Pleasure to chat to you, and we'll chat to you again soon.
Great. Nice chatting with you, Pat.
That was Chris Gatford of Hacklabs there in this week's sponsor interview. Big thanks to Hacklabs for all of its support of the Risky Business podcast. And that is it for this week's show. I hope you've enjoyed it. This week's feature track is by a band that started out as a new wave band in Melbourne in the late 70s. They're called The Models. At the time, there was a lot of experimental post-punk music happening in Melbourne. It was the so-called little band scene of the late 70s. And generally speaking, the music that came out of that scene was pretty awful. There's actually a great film set in the little band scene in Melbourne. It's called Dogs in Space. The late INXS frontman Michael Hutchence actually played the lead character, and it's well worth watching if you like a good indie flick. It's a very strange film, but I think it's fantastic. I think it's a masterpiece. You might hate it, so please don't hate mail me if you don't like it. But anyway, some of these new wave bands that came up at that time wound up pumping out some really good synth pop years later in the sort of mid-80s. And I think you can hear the influence of elements of the little band scene on this track in particular. This track was released in 1983. It's called I Hear Motion. And I think it's a great example of Aussie synth pop from a band that actually came up and cut its teeth during a period of out there post-punk experimentation. They sort of took that and channeled it in a pop direction. You can get this on iTunes. I hope you like it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.